It's Thursday, May 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, gunmen open fire in a crowded Israeli market.
First time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
The race is on for the White House, unless you ask Bernie Sanders. Also ahead, a possible British exit from the European Union and a 1990s cultural perspective of O.J. Simpson. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Two gunmen opened fire on shoppers and diners at a marketplace in Tel Aviv late Wednesday. There have been fatalities. Joining us from Tel Aviv is video journalist Sivan Raviv with more details.
There are four dead and six wounded, one of them in critical condition, as a result of what seems to have been a planned terrorist attack in Tel Aviv in a very busy Sirona compound. That's the name of Tel Aviv. It's a trendy area filled with shops and cafes, which sees a lot of Israeli and tourists. It appears two terrorists made their way to Tel Aviv this evening. They presumably dined at a local restaurant in that compound. And as witnesses report, they suddenly pulled out guns from their backpacks and began shooting. Police later arrived to the area and chased the suspects. There were gunshots. One of the terrorists was shot by Israeli police forces, and by now both have been apprehended and neutralized. From what we hear from witnesses, they say the gunshots went on for a long time, and police initially believed there may be more terrorists on scene, but at the moment it seems they have caught them all.
Sivan, it seems that there was some degree of coordination in this attack.
Well, definitely there were two terrorists that were working together. There were theories that there may be more, but at the moment police say it was just those two. They arrived to Tel Aviv, we're not sure from where yet, and planned out their attack in a sophisticated manner in which they pretended to be dining along with other people at that restaurant, that local restaurant, until they opened fire.
Sivan Raviv, video journalist from Tel Aviv, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Based in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem Post reporter Ben Hartman says the investigation may be difficult because of the rise in so-called lone wolf attacks. These attackers, Israeli authorities say, from the Hebron area.
Well, I mean, there'll be widespread condemnations, obviously a lot of statements and words. The problem is with these attacks, you know, there's no address for them necessarily. This is not when you had Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and all these actual organizations carrying out suicide bombings in the Second Intifada. If this is a lone wolf attack, which most of these in the last several months have been, there's not necessarily someone you can go after, an organization or something that you can really strike at. Now, it could be that they got assistance from people who are connected, from some sort of infrastructure that they can target. But after, you know, a grassroots sort of lone wolf terror attack like this, you don't necessarily really have a target to go after. And so that's part of what's made it hard to fight, you know, this terror wave the last several months. We could see restrictions on places in the West Bank, especially in the Hebron area, especially in their village and places around their village in the Hebron Hills. Their relatives, people they're close to, are going to get scooped up and investigated, interrogated, things like that. There could be more serious closures in the West Bank, but in terms of what military answers you have to something like this, I think they're going to be few and far between.
Israel has seen a relative lull in 9 months of Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians and police. VOA's Michael Lippin joins me in the studio now because, Michael, you were recently in the Sirona complex. If you could describe that for us.
Hi, Jim. That's right. I was actually at Sirona a couple of times in late April. I was visiting Tel Aviv at the time. And as Sivan Raviv was saying, it is an open-air mall with lots of high-end stores, fashion chains, Adidas, Levi's. There are bars and restaurants. I actually had an ice cream at one of them on a weeknight, much like the people who are caught up in this attack were doing this evening. And one thing that I thought was interesting when I was visiting Israel at the time, there were reports in the media of people expressing concerns about security at this site. Now, just to give people an idea of what it looks like, it's an open-air complex with several dozen little houses that some of which are more than 100 years old. They were built by German Christian migrants to the Holy Land. And that's one thing that makes it tough to control who comes in and out, because it's a couple of houses dotted around this plaza. The high-end stores and restaurants are located in these buildings. And really to secure the whole place, like a lot of Israeli indoor malls are secured, would mean putting up some kind of barrier. And that might take away from the kind of casual nature of this place. So that's the real challenge that Israeli authorities face, and how to prevent something like this from happening again over there.
And the challenge for authorities everywhere when dealing with soft targets like that. Michael Lippin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, we turn now to our social media segment, and International Edition's G. Abby Lee is right here in Studio 22 for a look about what people are talking about online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, is the hashtag California primary still trending?
Actually, it is, but that's not the only trending hashtag on yesterday's election. Just to recap the result, Hillary Clinton and, of course, Donald Trump won the state's nominating contest. But let's just focus on the Democratic side, because Trump had been the presumptive nominee for the party for some time. Clinton received nearly 56% of the votes, and her rival Bernie Sanders got more than 40%. The two main hashtags by Clinton supporters are hashtag Hillary2016 and hashtag Hill Yes, CA. Sanders supporters are using hashtag Still Sanders.
Well, Tuesday definitely was a historic moment for longtime politician Hillary Clinton, and we're going to have a little bit more about that in the program. What is she saying on Facebook?
She sent out several posts on Facebook since the result was announced. One of the first posts was a simple thank you, California, with a picture of her laughing at a rally. Another post is in Spanish, and yet another one, a tribute to her mother. Let's read some of the comments. One of the most popular comments is from a man named Garrett, who thanked everyone who voted for her, and nearly 1,000 people liked that comment. But another comment is quickly becoming even more popular, and it's by a former Sanders supporter who wrote, "He will now support Clinton for the good of the Democratic Party." That comment received more than 1,000 likes within 20 minutes. But not all of his supporters were quick to switch the camp. Some people are still using the hashtag, hashtag never Hillary.
Wow, that's harsh. Well, let's hear from Sanders himself. What's he tweeting?
He sent out a thank you tweet, including all six states that voted Tuesday and used the hashtag not me, us. And they include New Mexico, California, South and North Dakota, New Jersey, and Montana. Back to you, Jim.
All right. Great summary, G. Thank you so much. You may tweet your questions and comments to at VOA underscore IE. That's the International Edition Twitter stream. If you like, tag G and myself on those. Our handles are at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Here's some of the top stories we're following right now in Asia. Indian Prime Minister Modi addresses U.S. Congress, calls for closer ties between the United States and India. North Korea again seeing producing plutonium for nuclear bombs. Afghan officials dispute reported mass kidnapping in Kunduz. Police fire at Papua New Guinea protesters. Panama Papers link Cambodians to offshore firms. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website, and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Hillary Clinton has claimed victory in her bid to become the first woman to secure a U.S. major U.S. political party presidential nominee, and she met with supporters late Tuesday in Brooklyn, New York, after securing more victories in Tuesday's state primary election contests.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee. Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible.
President Obama congratulated her for her apparent history-making electoral journey. But her lone rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, speaking to supporters in California, vowed to stay in the race.
By the end of tonight, we'll have won, I believe, 22 state primaries and caucuses. We will have received well over 10 million votes. And what is most extraordinary to me is the fact that in virtually every single state, we have won by big numbers the votes of young people.
Bernie Sanders vowing to take his fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice all the way to the Philadelphia Convention in July. On the Republican side, presumptive nominee Donald Trump, facing no competition, swept all five state primary contests on Tuesday and met with his supporters in New York.
I'd like to begin by thanking the people of Montana, South Dakota, New Mexico, New Jersey, and California. We had some big, big days, and we have some big numbers coming in, very big numbers. I'm truly honored by your support. Together, we accomplished what nobody thought was absolutely possible. And you know what that is? We're only getting started, and it's going to be beautiful. Remember that.
Both Trump and Clinton appealed for support of Sanders voters ahead of the general election campaign leading to the November election. Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Sabato Crystal Ball website at the University of Virginia, was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty if Mr. Obama will endorse his fellow Democrat and former 2008 presidential rival Hillary Clinton.
You have to think that President Obama is going to come out and endorse Hillary Clinton relatively soon. I expect that the president's preference would be for Bernie Sanders to remove himself from the race before he does that. So perhaps the meeting is an opportunity for Sanders to express some of his desires to the president, such that the president could then try to maneuver the party in such a way that many of those desires might actually be, you know, added to the party platform, might be, you know, very much addressed during the general election campaign. Sanders is in a position where he still has some leverage given the number of people who voted for him, the obvious divides that exist within the Democratic Party, particularly if you look at things like age. I mean, all the exit polls have shown routinely that young voters overwhelmingly favored Sanders against Clinton. I mean, to a degree that is breathtaking, especially if you think about the fact that Barack Obama routinely beat Clinton among young voters in 2008. Well, Sanders has done much better than Obama did. I mean, Sanders does have some leverage here. But on the other hand, I think that the problem for Sanders is that if he is seen to be hurting the party's ability to unify going toward the general election and perhaps, you know, potentially endangering the party's ability to beat Donald Trump in November, that could hang over him like a pall. That could very much detract from his legacy as a candidate, as a politician, as someone who has worked for change his whole life.
Mr. Trump, no surprise, swept all five state contests on the Republican side. What kind of election campaign do you see shaping up?
It's hard to see this campaign not being pretty brutal. It's pretty clear that Clinton is probably going to over and over just repeat the phrase that Trump does not have the temperament to be president. And, you know, given many of the comments that he's made, I think they're going to have some ammunition to work with. But at the same time, there's no reason to think Trump isn't going to level some pretty serious personal attacks on Clinton, talk a lot about her relationship with her husband, former president. Then, of course, also Trump is going to very much be able to use the email scandal and go after her for that, not being sufficiently trustworthy, for having made what was clearly much more than just an error in judgment. I mean, the fact that it's under FBI investigation, it may have been illegal.
Well, for her part, Hillary Clinton has portrayed Trump as temperamentally unfit to be president, while Trump said he's planning a major speech next week in which he says he will discuss all the things that have taken place with the Clintons. Well, should be interesting. Another documentary is out about O.J. Simpson. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, the approval of the European Union has fallen sharply across the continent. That's raising fears in Brussels of a contagion effect for the upcoming referendum on Britain's membership of the bloc. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, a so-called Brexit would likely be felt far beyond Britain's borders.
The Washington-based Pew Research Center interviewed 10,000 people across Europe. Their answers showed that skepticism over the EU is not confined to Britain. France views the bloc even more unfavorably than its neighbor across the English Channel, with just 38% of people having a positive opinion of the EU, compared to 69% in 2004. In Spain, approval for the EU has fallen from 80% to 47%. A British vote to leave the EU could lead to demands for similar referendums across the continent. A British divorce from the EU would likely be lengthy and bitter, says Oliver.
The rest of the European Union is looking to either punish the United Kingdom for withdrawing, so there has to be an economic cost. The UK can't withdraw and not feel any punishment, any costs and so forth, and get a new relationship with the EU, or else that might encourage other member states to do the same thing.
Pew researchers said much of the disapproval of the EU is related to its handling of the refugee crisis. Over a million migrants arrived in Greece in 2015. Disapproval of Brussels' migrant policies there runs at 94%. With disapproval of the EU growing across the continent, analysts say a British exit could have much wider consequences for Europe and beyond. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
There is, of course, much more to this story, and you can find it at voanews.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, hot on the heels of the docudrama The People vs. O.J. Simpson, for binge watchers, you've now got a 7.5-hour documentary to look at. The life of the former football star O.J. Simpson, from his time in San Francisco through his college career at USC to his now infamous murder trial. International Edition's David Byrd says that in O.J. Made in America, director Ezra Edelman looks at Simpson's life in its cultural context, America in the late 20th century.
If you're a black man in America, you're fighting our war.
Two totally separate worlds.
For us, O.J. was colorless.
Ezra Edelman is an African-American director known for his sports documentaries, including Brooklyn Dodgers, The Ghosts of Flatbush, Magic and Bird, A Courtship of Rivals, and Cutie and the Boxer. Ezra says he set out to do something other than an O.J. Simpson murder trial film. He wanted to look at O.J. Simpson as a cultural icon, a black man in the late 1960s who wanted to be a celebrity. As part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series, Edelman was granted interviews with key players in the Simpson trial, including former LAPD Detective Mark Furman and prosecutor Marcia Clark. The director says he got that access when people learned he was looking to tell a broader story of O.J.'s life in the context of being black in Los Angeles in the latter third of the 20th century.
I have 5 hours, and what I'm interested in is explaining sort of everything that led up to the trial, who O.J. was as a person, sort of getting into his identity from a racial standpoint, his pursuit of celebrity. But also, I want to tell this story about Los Angeles. I want to tell a story about, you know, this sort of dynamic between the black community and the LAPD, and where this sort of tension and this distrust how it was bred and how did we arrive at this point in 1994.
The filmmaker conducted 73 interviews and worked through hundreds of hours of archival footage from Simpson's football career, media interviews, the LAPD archives, and the 1994 trial. Edelman says that he wanted people to see more than one side of O.J. Simpson.
And he's just removed from having come from San Francisco and having grown up in public housing and, you know, in a very black world. And all of a sudden he arrives at this lily white place with a lot of wealthy students, conservative elite, and this transformation that happens where 2 years later, yes, he was the star football player and the Heisman Trophy winner and won a national championship, but he's this pioneering commercial pitchman as a black athlete before he ever played a down in the NFL. And that two-year period of how someone sort of flips like that was fascinating to me.
The film also goes through the now famous 1994 murder trial and the not guilty verdict. O.J. Simpson is still serving a 33-year sentence for armed robbery and kidnapping. He will be eligible for parole next year. O.J. Simpson, Made in America, had a brief theatrical run to qualify for Academy Award competition. It will air on U.S. television beginning June 11th. In Washington, I'm David Byrne.
Great job by David Byrne. 7.5-hour documentary in about 3 minutes. I like that. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com anytime you like. We're also on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Come back when you can. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Conference of Western Attorneys General recently hosted its Forum on Oral Trials and attracted close to 400 members of the legal profession from San Luis Potosí, Mexico. Among them were personnel from the Attorney General's Office, the Public Defender's Office, law school students and faculty, bar associations, and private attorneys. Senior litigators from the U.S., including District Attorney John Haroldson from Benton County, Oregon, and Anthony DeSilva, Deputy Attorney General, California Department of Justice, made presentations during the event that also featured a mock oral trial. The event, which took place mid-May, is part of the United States government's support for Mexican public sector legal professionals and is funded under the U.S.-Mexico Merida Initiative. The forum was inaugurated by San Luis Potosí Attorney General Federico Garza Herrera. Speaking immediately after the event, Robert Arce from the U.S. Consulate General Monterrey noted, "Oral trials will boost the efficiency, transparency, and accountability of the justice system. The legal and law enforcement professionals who came to this forum are committed to meeting their responsibilities under the new criminal justice system. The United States government is privileged to support Mexico's historic transition to a new criminal justice system, and we were delighted to welcome senior litigators from the United States to share their knowledge and experiences with the audience here today. The United States government supports the consolidation of the accusatory system in Mexico through capacity-building programs for federal and state judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, criminal investigators, forensic experts, and other members of the judiciary, as well as for university law students and professors. Since 2008, under the Merida Initiative, the Conference of Western Attorneys General trained over 25,000 members of the legal and law enforcement communities in Mexico through study tours in countries operating under an accusatory system, seminars, and forums. The U.S. Justice Department has trained over 15,000 justice sector operators in the fundamentals of the accusatorial system. Through other programs funded under the Merida Initiative, the United States government is supporting the training of 1,600 police officers as first responder instructors, helping to equip courtrooms for oral trials and assisting forensic labs to achieve international accreditation. The United States is proud to work with Mexico to support a justice system that serves the needs and protects the rights of the Mexican people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.